Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a march to save our schools from privatization and high-stakes testing, a conference on democracy, and black federal workers are under siege but get no help from President Obama.
But first, the hunger strike that began at California's infamous Pelican Bay prison continues, with the health of some inmates said to be badly deteriorating. Supporters on the outside have launched a series of demonstrations. We spoke with Clive Young of the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition. Young is himself a former prison inmate. He says many thousands of prisoners nationwide are held in conditions much like Pelican Bay.
There's 10,000 prisoners who are confined to isolation cells across the country, and this is nothing short of torture. I say it's barbaric, and it is that, and it's also torture, where prisoners are confined to small cells for 23 hours a day. They're deprived of any sensory stimulation, and many of these cells are soundproof. They have no contact with humans at all. If you want to refer to the guards as human, that's the only human contact that they have. And they're let out 1 hour a day, in some cases, for exercise. And they have to undergo a cavity search as well as being handcuffed when they're let out of their cells for any reason. So this is barbaric, and it's unbelievable in a country that calls itself a land of freedom and democracy. It's just completely barbaric and unbelievable.
And many also say it violates international law and violates U.S. constitutional law.
Exactly. A lot of the people who've written on this subject, and one of them is Laura Magnani, who's associated with American Friends Service Committee. Her book is entitled Buried Alive, and that's essentially what prisoners are subjected to. They're essentially buried alive for decades, not just for, you know, when I was in prison, I was in a segregation cell for months at a time, but not for years. I mean, this is nothing but breaking people down and destroying their minds, and oftentimes they go insane. From what I understand, there's 5% of the prisoners who are incarcerated in this type of situation in isolation cells, but the suicides are 70%. 70% of the suicides in prison are usually in those units. So this is just outrageous and unacceptable.
Now, of course, the prison officials say that all this is to increase security within the prison.
Yes.
But how does sensory deprivation increase security?
That's beyond my comprehension of how that's actually well, what they say is that they're putting prisoners in there because they're gang members. And one of the things that they're attempting to do is to prevent them from communicating with other gang members in other prisons and communicating with members on the outside of the prison. But we have to cut through the chase and get to the real issue here. The reason why you have so many prisoners today, black and Latino, warehoused in these cells, whether they're isolation or otherwise, I think the total population now is swollen to 2.3 million when it was about 500,000 in 1980. This is nothing less and nothing short of they're taking measures to prevent what happened in the 1960s. There's no other reason for this. I mean, Nixon declared a war on drugs in 1970, I believe it was. It's just the 40th anniversary of his announcement of the war on drugs. And that war on drugs was very political and very consciously designed to use a stick against those who were rebelling at that time and to prevent such a thing from ever happening again. Prisoners like those ones, or people like those ones who are confined in prison today, were the very ones who were in the street shaking the system to its very foundation. So this is a very deliberate and conscious plan to prevent that from ever happening again.
Mass black incarceration has been described as a counterinsurgency program, as opposed to COINTELPRO, which was aimed at the black leadership. The mass black incarceration strategy was aimed at masses of black folks, throwing millions in jail.
That's exactly right, and I think there's a tremendous amount of merit to what you just said, and it was what I was getting at. In other words, there is an attempt now to basically preempt any effort for black people to mount the kind of struggle that they mounted in the 1960s, to preempt that by actually warehousing and incarcerating, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people in these prisons. And let's go further than that and say that the situation that many of the young black youth find themselves in the inner city is one in which crime is a rational choice for them. In fact, there was a conservative commentator who spoke about this. He said, for many of them, crime is a rational choice, given that you've got a situation. When I was growing up, you know, there were factories, there were jobs that people could, you know, get. Now, many of those jobs have been moved overseas, and you find, or into the suburbs, you know, which are inaccessible to many of the youth in the inner cities, and large percentages of them are unemployed and unemployable. And so the future for them, for many of them, is prison.
Given that this mass incarceration situation stems from a larger economic context and political strategy, how important is it to support these prisoners in California?
It's extremely important. First of all, let's just step back for a minute and look at the fact that these prisoners are risking their lives to call attention to and to resist the kind of barbaric treatment that they're receiving behind the walls of Pelican Bay. But this not only applies to Pelican Bay, this kind of thing is going on throughout the country. And I think people in their hundreds and thousands need to rally to the support of these prisoners, because their demands will not be met and they will not be able to redress their grievances without the support of hundreds and thousands throughout the country. And I'll go a step further than that and say that should be part of building massive resistance to the warehousing of blacks and Latinos. For the most part, that's who's warehoused. It's racially targeted mass incarceration. That there needs to be a movement mounted in this country, not that dissimilar than what was done in the 1960s in terms of in opposition to Jim Crow. So I think there needs to be a movement mounted that's very massive, both in support of the strike of the prisoners, who are really just shining a spotlight on what's going on behind prison walls, but also in opposition to mass incarceration. A call that's gone out for strategy sessions in New York and L.A. in opposition to mass incarceration. If anyone's interested in that, they can contact me at youngclyde8@gmail.com.
That was Clive Young speaking in solidarity with the hunger strikers at Pelican Bay State Prison in California.
Republicans and President Obama are determined to make huge cuts in Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, all in the name of reducing the budget deficit. But the union, National Nurses United, isn't having it. Spokesperson Donna Smith says the budget shortfalls can be made up simply by taxing the trading of stocks on Wall Street.
Well, it seems logical to the nurses when they took a look at the problems the country is experiencing at the hands of the wealthy and powerful interests on Wall Street. And we hear so much about shared sacrifice in this environment, when in fact, the only people who've really been sacrificing thus far are those people who are not in the wealthy and powerful reaches of our society. And those who have profited most wildly off speculation on Wall Street about the bailouts that came in 2008 and afterwards have been those who have paid the least in taxes. So when the nurses took a look at it and thought about what makes the most sense, we looked back in our history. 40 years ago, we had a transaction tax, and we only just in the last four decades did away with taxing the wealthy in a more fair and reasonable way. So it just seemed like this was the well past time to go forward and say this is what we need to do to be equitable, to repair the damage on Main Street, and to have everybody truly paying a share of what needs to be paid to fix the damage.
And this kind of gives the lie to the right wing, which says that the United States is broke.
Oh, that's so not true. And, you know, I read this morning, even this morning, I read in USA Today, they were talking about how raising the eligibility age of Medicare would save us $128 billion over the next few years until 2016. And I thought, oh, my God, the misinformation that flies. Now, that raw number apparently came from the Congressional Budget Office and their scoring of what it would save to cut out 65 to 67-year-olds from the Medicare system. And yet that's less than half the story, and people should think logically to know that. If we cut those people out of Medicare and having those kinds of benefits, they will then have to go out in the open market and, first of all, try and purchase health insurance policies, which will rob money that they've now been spending in their communities and businesses and on Main Street. It will take that money and funnel it into the health insurance industry so that we will lose even more money out of the small businesses and local businesses where people who are on Social Security and people who are retired have been spending, paying taxes, and being a vibrant part of the economy. There is no scoring talked about in that article of what that would cost us in our local and state governments and what further pressures that would put on our tax revenues to take that money out of the system that then retirees would not have paid through the Medicare program. It's just the whole discussion right at the moment seems to be centered around fear-mongering and making people afraid that it's Medicare and it's Social Security that are bankrupting the system when nothing could be further from the truth. And so that's why the nurses, when they thought there's not, it makes so much sense to go back to the people and say, think about it logically. Think about who has not been paying their fair share going through this and who's really been shouldering the burden of the suffering in our society. And let's do what's right.
People usually think of Republicans when they think about assaults on Medicare, assaults on Social Security. But Barack Obama, before he was even sworn in as president, announced that he would be putting all the entitlements, including Medicare, including Social Security, on the table.
Yeah, and that's a conundrum, isn't it? That's surprising to so many of us who, you know, put so much faith and trust in the fact that if we elected someone who had sounded so progressive in his lead up to running for president and being a state senator from Illinois and being a U.S. senator from the state of Illinois, who had sounded so much like what we wanted to hear, that once he became our president, that surely he would never be one of the people who would go after targeting those programs. I refuse to call them entitlements because, as far as I'm concerned, they're earned benefits. We all pay in through the course of our working lives, and those are things that we promise to one another as a sound and a caring society. There are things that we trust that we're going to get. So to me, there are earned benefits that we give to one another. But has that been somewhat troubling to see Barack Obama be the one who sometimes, even in the past couple of weeks, takes the lead on suggesting cuts to Medicare or raising the eligibility age for Medicare? Of course that's upsetting. And I even shared with somebody the other day, if he were to come out and say the things I'd like to cut from Medicare are the waste, fraud, and abuse like that was perpetrated on the Medicare system by Rick Scott, the now Republican governor, who when he was the head of HCA, that would be one thing. If he would come out and say, I'm perfectly committed to making sure that benefits stay in place and are protected for everyone, but I want to cut out the things that are hurting Medicare and making it less strong, that would be one thing, but that's not what we're hearing from this president. So you're right, it's very upsetting and troubling, and you want to just say, this is not a Republican or Democratic issue when someone is ill. Nurses never ask what your political affiliation is when you present at the hospital for care. All they care about is that you need treatment and you need help, and that's what they provide. So that's what the nurses are saying right now to this society. If we're really about that, we're going to have to be about that.
It looks like the debt ceiling controversy has turned into a give up Medicare, change Social Security, or else argument.
It does sound like that, doesn't it? It seems like that's almost a demand in some ways. So frustrating to listen to it and upsetting. And I know so many of our nurses have fought so hard for the patients that they serve and within their own families and their own communities. Nurses live on Main Street and they're hurting. They've put forward what's now on the Main Street Contract for America. Our nurses in Michigan yesterday, in Lansing, Michigan, at the state capitol, held a soup kitchen to call attention to the cuts that the governor there has done to the state budget. And so many people are hurting in this right now. And to have this false discussion about the debt limit, and the debt limit's a a completely separate issue from what we do with spending in the federal budget going forward. And it's just such a false assumption and sends so many false messages to the people in this country that the two have now been linked together, that we either cut Medicare, we cut Medicaid, and we cut Social Security from those who least can afford to have those cuts, and we keep in place, according to the Republican side, the tax benefits to those who can most afford to pay a little bit more in taxes, that it's just harmful to the overall fabric of our society to hear that kind of talk at a time when so many people are hurting. It's not the right time for that from either party. There needs to be, somewhere there must be some common sense, but apparently right at the moment that has to rest with the people and with the nurses and not with their elected officials, which is sad.
Have you been encouraged or discouraged by the reaction of congressional lawmakers to your proposal to tax the traitors?
Well, that's a mixed bag, isn't it? There are some who are always very much on the side of doing what's right. You know, of course, Bernie Sanders in the Senate is always such a strong advocate of working people and of working families and of protecting what needs to be protected. But he's one voice who stands always on the side of working people in the Senate. And in the House, you will hear sometimes members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus will sometimes talk as if they're going to stand with us and be with us. But we get nervous when we hear things like, we'll protect the most robust plan we can. We heard that word robust a little while ago when we heard them talk about health care reform and drawing this line in the sand, but they didn't stay on that line very long. They jumped right across it and right into compromise with the Republican Party. So we get very nervous when we'll hear some inklings that people are with us and going to protect things, but we're just nervous. You know, we feel like we've got to stay strong and tell these folks, the nurses have said very clearly, anyone who votes to cut Social Security benefits or Medicare will not get the endorsement from the nurses going into 2012. And nurses are an important voice in this society. They're still the most trusted profession in this country, bar none. And there's a good reason for that, because nurses have the least motivation to tell anybody something that's not factual. There's nothing in it to be gained for them. So one of the things we say is, if you won't protect those basic programs for us, we're not going to endorse you. It's just that clear. And we don't like to be in that position, but we feel as though we've been put in a position that there's no other way.
Donna Smith of National Nurses United.
President Obama froze the wages of federal workers as part of his austerity program. Blacks make up a disproportionate share of government employees, but their numbers are falling. Tanya Ward Jordan of the Black Grassroots Federal Workers Organization Coalition for Change has noted a dramatic increase in on-the-job racial discrimination complaints since Obama took office.
We've had a lot of calls from across the United States from almost every agency as A through Z. In fact, we even put together a video on YouTube that people could check out. It's called Racism in the Federal Government from A through Z, and it's just rampant. We hear a lot of times people from agriculture say they're the last plantation, interior think they're the last plantation, but what we found uniformly throughout the federal government that this is a pervasive problem. Actually, the EEOC's recent report is called the Annual Report of Federal Workforce. They come out with it every year. For 2010, what they reported was there was an increase, a spike in the complaints. They noted that other minorities, for example, Hispanic employment increased, Asian Americans increased, everybody increased except for African Americans. So the Coalition for Change, Inc., we address racial discrimination in the federal government, particularly as it applies to African Americans, because we found that we're the hardest hit throughout this recession. Even before the recession, we were always hardest hit, the last to be recruited and the first ones out the door. And this recession is just proven a more of a hardship, because we found that these managers now are engineering our demise, and they're coming up with, according to various calls that we've been getting, trumped up charges. You can be a long-standing employee, and all of a sudden your performance is at a deficit. They're using this as a tool for retaliation now.
So black employment is down, but complaints are up. It sounds like it's open season on black folks in federal government.
It is indeed open season on black people in federal government. It seems like no national group is really speaking to that. And it was for that very reason that I founded the Coalition for Change, Inc., C4C. I myself am an injured federal worker from racial discrimination and retaliation, and I started a grassroots organization to address this very problem. It is very much open season. One thing that I definitely want to say is, which pains me, is that there is a underlying thought that they have enough black people in federal government. And I say that because the Office of Personnel Management, which is supposed to be the premier human resource office for the entire federal government, basically has, you pretty much could say, have a quota on it, because what they say is that black people are fully represented. To me and to our organization, that's a code for we have enough of you. To say that you have fully represented African Americans in the workforce, how they come up with that, they compare our representation to the civilian labor workforce. Well, we already know that analogy is flawed because they're not hiring enough of us in the civilian labor workforce. And if OPM had done their homework, historically, African Americans all the way from the Great Migration came from the South to the North for these quote-unquote good government jobs. However, now what has taken place, because the private sector wouldn't hire us originally. That's why we came to the federal government. Now, not only is the private sector shutting their door to us, but the federal government has drawn the line and said we're fully represented. So they don't even outreach to us the way they do with other groups. I also would like to say that it's painfully, even when they say we're fully represented, painfully, black males has been on a decrease for the longest time. We are terribly underrepresented in that regard, with regard to the black males, and that tends to go silent a lot.
One suspects that part of that term overrepresented includes the fact that you have a black president, and that now that black folks have a black president, what do you have to complain about?
It's sad. We find, and it hurts me. It truly does. It hurts me. It hurts many of us in our organization, because I'm a proud American to see the first African American in office, a brilliant man. And we recognize that he's really finds himself quite often, they say, between Barack and a hard place because of the persons who want to bring him down. The Coalition for Change, Inc., C4C, wants to be a group that provides strategy, to provide solutions, to help the president and his administration with some long-standing systemic discrimination and retaliation-type problems. However, the door is silent to us with regard to this present administration. We're approaching this administration just as various advocates of us have approached prior administrations. But unfortunately, there's a school of thought, not with our organizations, but with some more established organizations, civil rights organizations, that this is not the time to address those issues. But if not now, then when? And that's our question, because too many of us are just finding ourselves by the wayside. I mean, this employment problem is really impacting negatively the black community. And what people have to understand, we have to look out for the federal workers, because what goes on with regard to the whole racial culture and the retaliation culture impacts not just the federal workforce, but it impacts the programs and the services that the federal government, the public officials, are responsible for overseeing. And so that's why you have cases like what happened to the black farmer, because you have some public officials who do discriminatory type of retaliatory things, making these type of policies, and then nothing, there's no accountability at the end of the day. Where's the discipline when they discriminate or retaliate against people in the workforce, or when they have biased policies that impact farmers, like the black farmer situation?
You've asked President Obama to send a firm and unequivocal statement on the issue of racial discrimination in the federal sector. But you've also said that some civil rights organizations are giving him a pass without him having sent that message.
Yes, that is so true. And I don't want to badmouth any organization, but I can actually say that I walk with many of the premier organizations. I've actually been side by side with some of the notable people who are now silent. Okay. There was a legislation called the No Fear Act, and we got the No Fear Act is a notification of Federal Employee Anti-Discrimination and Retaliation Act. We had assemblies and, if you will, protest marches to get that legislation passed. And at that time, Reverend Al Sharpton was with us. We have tried to reach out, I guess, at this point. I don't know why that hasn't taken place. We can't get the same type of attention to the matters that we put forward then under previous administrations. We can't get that same attention now. I was previously also with the NAACP, and we've sent letters to them, we've reached out to them, but we're not getting that same type feedback. We need help. And I'm telling you, we're getting calls from former EEOC administrative judges, that's EEOC, that's Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. We're getting calls from EEOC investigators who are saying, please help. And it's interesting, I'm just the injured employee myself who just said, I'm fed up. And so I thank you so much for giving us this vehicle. And if people could, you know, just visit our website, it's coalition4change.org. They can find out more about what we're about and how we're trying to get that issue out there.
And you're talking about in your press release, white supervisors calling African-American federal employees monkeys.
Absolutely. And it goes beyond that. We have even worse stories. But in this particular case, the person is, to our knowledge, still works there. We actually wrote, he was the U.S. Department of Interior manager. He worked for the Office of the Solicitor, and I understand he still does. And he interfered improperly with the hiring selection of a highly qualified African-American male, to the point where the EEOC judge who was overseeing the case said that the African-American male was superiorly more qualified than the person who was selected for the job by this Craig Littlejohn. Now, U.S. Department of Interior, to our knowledge, has done nothing to discipline this person. We wrote in two letters. Our acting president, Philip Taylor, wrote two letters asking for discipline. Instead of giving discipline to this Craig Littlejohn, who not just overlooked this black, superbly qualified black male, he also, according to the EEO complaint, any black person who was under his supervision, he transferred them out of headquarters office. But nothing is being done with regard to discipline for him or others who abuse federal workers, be it the black minorities or anybody who speaks out against injustice. Now, I will say this, Coalition for Change advocates on behalf of African-American black employees, but we also recognize that any employee who speaks out against injustice in the federal worker are often retaliated against. And what happens, there is no accountability. And when I say that, there's no discipline and or no monetary repercussions that happens to the perpetrator.
And apparently no fear from the guy upstairs.
Nothing. We haven't heard any statement, any policy, no executive order. We haven't heard anything. And it's so disappointing to us. I highly respect the president's, his brilliance, and for him to, in my lifetime, I never thought I'd see an African-American president, nor did any of our members. We are not placing this on his shoulder, though, because he's a black man. We are not doing that. We're putting this before him. He is the head of the executive office. We are employees, present and former employees, and we're coming to him as our leader, as we have come before any other president, and will continue to do. It doesn't seem fair to our organization that we go silent during this administration and raise up on the next. That would not be fair. That in itself would be discriminatory.
That was Tanya Ward Jordan of the Coalition for Change in Washington, D.C.
Teachers and supporters of public education from around the country will converge on Washington, D.C. on July 30th for a rally and march to save our schools. Former teacher Sabrina Stephen Shoup says high-stakes testing and political assaults on teachers are a clear and present danger to American public schooling.
There's a number of different reasons why this is so threatening. We just see constantly that this overemphasis on testing has degraded the quality of education. Just this past week, we've had a number of cheating scandals burst. So we saw problems in Atlanta. There's another cheating scandal going on in Philadelphia. I just read about another one popping up. So we keep seeing these instances where, because the stakes attached to the test are so high and because the schools aren't being given additional resources to meet these higher standards, people are getting desperate. They're worried about losing their jobs. They're worried about, you know, not being able to support their families. They're going to all sorts of measures in order to get those test scores up. To me, what's an even bigger problem with that, though, is that it's degrading the quality of the education. So I've been in schools, I've worked in schools, where the entire curriculum is starting to look exactly like the test. That would be a problem if it weren't for the fact that, you know, life does not look like these tests. These kids are being put in a situation where they can't think for themselves. They can't think, you know, critically or reason, because they're so used to seeing everything come up in the format that it appears on these tests and in this low-quality curriculum. So I've actually had situations where a skill came up in context that students had been drilled on and had tested successfully, but they had no idea what the, you know, when to use a skill in real life. So that's worthless. There's that piece of the problem. There's also just this creeping privatization. So in a lot of the turnaround strategies that happen for these schools that are found to be, quote-unquote, failing is that they get turned over to a charter school operator, or they're mandated to get a certain type of changes in curriculum, and the types of curriculum that are approved are usually these box programs that are being sold by, you know, these big companies. And so it's not as though they're actually giving them additional support to be better. They're not saying, okay, here, you know, what's your plan to improve? How are you going to make the schools better? They're saying, if you don't meet these certain guidelines, then we're going to force you into one of four choices, and that's it. And it usually doesn't work. There's no research evidence to say that these turnaround strategies are successful.
What is more scandalous, the cheating or the creation of a system in which teachers feel compelled to cheat?
You know, I have a hard time with that. On the one hand, it disgusts me that people would cheat, change answers, all these different things that we know people are doing. But at the same time, when you see this happening on such a large scale, after a certain point, you have to say to yourself, we can't keep blaming the individual if it's this wide scale a problem. If every person in, you know, New York City all of a sudden became sick, we wouldn't blame them all for not working harder to be healthy. And so I think, you know, we put people in a sick situation, they're going to behave in a sick way, and that's what's happened here.
If 82% of the nation's schools are in danger of being declared failures, is that a problem of the measuring system or the schools?
That's a problem with the measuring system. When you look at how people are satisfied with their schools, the actual results of our schools, when we take out poverty, for example, our schools overwhelmingly are performing quite well compared to other schools. It's only in the high poverty schools that we really see these intense problems. The other thing is that 70% and higher of Americans would give an A or a B to the schools that their children attend. And so that's a huge disconnect to go from, you know, I know my child's school is doing a good job educating them, to 80% of the nation's schools are failing. And even the most diehard corporate reformers like Arne Duncan admit that there's something wrong with the way we're judging the schools if 82% are said to be failing.
It seems that No Child Left Behind and its attendant policies and Race to the Top are designed to force the creation of a national network of charter schools.
The charter schools piece is very interesting because there's so many different types of charter schools, from, you know, kind of community-based ones to these for-profit chains. But the bigger thing that, you know, you have things like the Common Core Standards, which even the chief of staff to our education secretary came right out and said. She came right out and said, you know, this opens up a national market for curriculum and tests, and it's a great thing. That, you know, that really is their motivation on a lot of this.
A national market. That's a businessman's term applied to education.
Absolutely. Basically, what she's saying is that these little kind of local solutions, you know, you have a little boutique operator who markets a program that is tailored for their local school district and is very helpful, blah, blah, blah. She openly poo-poos that in this piece. It's really stunning. And is basically saying, oh, that's no way to build a market. Now that we've got, you know, the Common Core curriculum, the biggest providers will be able to just make one set of materials instead of having to tailor each set of materials to fit each different curriculum that's required in each different state or different district. So that has two consequences. One is that it standardizes curriculum for everybody across all 50 states. The other consequence, too, is that, you know, now these big publishing companies, which are already taking power out of people's hands in terms of education, now you can even downsize those companies because you don't have to have a Texas curriculum expert. You don't have to have a Connecticut curriculum expert if everybody's got the same curriculum.
Your July 30th Save the Schools March has an impressive list of educators, but the Obama administration doesn't seem to put much trust in teachers.
Right, and that's part of the big problem here is that we're trying to raise our voices and say this is unacceptable. You can't listen to business leaders and not listen to teachers. You can't listen to business leaders and not listen to parents, and that's also a group of people who's well represented among our endorsers. We're saying that we need to put the local stakeholders back in charge of this thing, because when we have business leaders in charge of education, they're going to increase business opportunities. That's to say nothing of increased achievement, because we haven't seen it in the decades since they've gotten so actively involved in schools.
The thrust of the charter school effort is certainly in inner cities, in the Harlems and Bed-Stuys and Washington, D.C.'s of the country. Is that because inner cities need charter schools more, or because those populations are more vulnerable to these experimentations?
Whether it's in school structure or curriculum, there's a lot of experimenting on low-income children, unfortunately. But the other piece that really expands the market for these kinds of schools is that No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, basically, if you are found to be a, quote-unquote, failing school, there are, one of four choices that you are forced to accept as a way to turn around your school, and one of them is to be converted to a charter school. So that's why a lot of these things keep popping up, because schools are literally being shut down and then reopened as charters because of their low test performance. And then those charters kept getting shut down and reopened, and it's a lot of churn. It's a really disruptive environment for kids.
Sabrina Stevens Shoup of Save Our Schools.
The same anti-abortion forces that put up posters targeting African Americans, declaring that the most dangerous place for a black baby is in the womb, have launched a similar campaign among Latinos. Sikivu Hutchinson, a frequent Black Agenda Report contributor, has been in the thick of the confrontation.
The Latino Partnership for Conservative Principles is the primary architect of this latest assault on communities of color. And they cited some billboards in South L.A. that more or less regurgitated that canard that the most dangerous place, for now a Latino child is in the womb. And fortunately, activist forces in the South L.A. and greater L.A. County community converged to get these billboards dismantled. The California Latina for Reproductive Justice organization spearheaded that effort. And this was on the heels of a very well-attended event that occurred at the, I believe it was the L.A. Coliseum, that featured rumored presidential candidate Rick Perry. And Rick Perry has, of course, been a very staunch, draconian, fascistic, advocate of rolling back women's right to abortion in Texas. And so he descended in L.A. and roused the primarily Latino crowd, Mexican-American. And the message was, again, that women of color, Latinas in particular, are being imperiled by all of these liberatory choices that they have currently within what little remains of the American social welfare safety net, vis-a-vis reproductive choice and reproductive justice. And that this is fundamentally in opposition to the religious, Catholic, pious values that Latino communities hold. And so the irony of this gathering was that we had several very prominent Mexican telenovela stars that actually came out, in support of this effort. And the other irony was that, of course, Rick Perry has been a very staunch proponent of extremely repressive anti-immigrant legislation in Texas, specifically SB9, which would, quote-unquote, crack down on sanctuary cities. And this is purely fiction, a figment of the reactionary right's imagination, because no such sanctuary cities exist in Texas. But this is, of course, part of a whole ripple of anti-immigrant fascistic legislation that's been implemented in the Southwest and in the Deep South, over the past several months. So it's a very dangerous convergence that we're seeing between these forces, dangerous and ironic.
Do you think that these forces were encouraged by their campaign in the black community to expand it to the Latino community?
Yeah, well, that's been part of the rhetoric and the propaganda coming from the Latino Partnership, that this is in some ways being articulated as a kind of a nationalistic campaign, again, designed to really harken back to a kind of cult of true womanhood within the Latino communities. And so I think that the partnership essentially felt left out. I mean, you had these extremely conservative, reactionary black forces allied with the white religious right, specifically the Radiance Foundation and some other very well-funded foundations that bankrolled this campaign. And so the way that this plays out in South L.A., because there's such a big convergence between African-Americans and Latinos in terms of the demographics, you know, of South L.A. South L.A. is now, in many parts, predominantly Latino, you know, in historically African-American-dominated strongholds like Watts. They're now predominantly Latino. So you see a lot of the same resonances, you know, with regard to this intersection, you know, of hyper-religiosity, the crackdown on liberatory choices that are being conferred that are allowed women of color, you know, vis-a-vis reproductive health and reproductive choice, and these very conservative, extremely reactionary iterations of ethnic nationalism, if you will.
In the black community, these forces tap into a nationalism that fears that there are efforts to curtail black numbers. Is there a similar appeal among Latinos?
Yes, superficially, but in terms of the reality, and again, you know, reality really has no bearing when we're talking about the fascistic right, the third world fascistic right, the third world fascistic right being co-opted by the white European, you know, fascistic right. There's no real resonance in terms of reality. The reality is that the average number of children that are born by Latina women is 3. And there is no grave threat to the Latino population, you know, in terms of this appeal to the propaganda that there are disproportionate numbers of Latinas, you know, getting abortions. That particular statistic has been cited with regard to African-American women. And African-American women, you know, comprise the greatest numbers of those seeking abortion. But that claim cannot be made for Latino communities, you know, particularly given the birth rate.
I know that you don't bandy around that term fascist and fascistic cavalierly. Please explain how you use it in this context.
In this context, I'm using it with regard to this notion that the state has a right and a claim to abolishing women's right to self-determination and their human right to exercise power and control over their lives and their destinies. And the way in which Christian fascistic schemes have been deployed in order to justify, rationalize, and naturalize that kind of regime of control. So that's the way that I'm using it.
And yet these same forces usually claim to be against bigger government.
Right. And that's been the contradiction that obviously, you know, radical and progressive feminists and others, you know, within the radical and progressive social justice community have raised time and again. That, you know, when you see, you know, these issues of, you know, cracking down on undocumented immigrant rights, trying to deny women, you know, their fundamental human right to reproductive justice and reproductive choice, trying to dismantle social welfare in the United States. You know, I mean, all of these movements to basically, you know, reclaim a space for hyper-capitalism without apology, that would seem to go against the grain of a more libertarian ethos that people need to let others live and let live, that, you know, the government, you know, shouldn't be, you know, exercising, you know, undue power and control, you know, autocratic, you know, power and control over the way in which individuals and communities live their lives.
That was Sikivu Hutchinson speaking from Los Angeles.
On August 24th, a convention dedicated to the cause of democracy will be convened in Madison, Wisconsin. The event, which is billed as the first National Democracy Convention, will include no less than 9 mini-conventions on subjects such as economic democracy, media democracy, and education for democracy. David Cobb is one of the organizers. He says the convention is designed to attract the widest constituencies for radical change.
Well, yes, it is, and that's because we who are organizing this event recognize it, that the problem in this country is power. That is to say, so many of us work on peace and justice issues, racial justice issues, environmental protection issues, and underlying all of those problems are the fact that a small ruling elite have hijacked all of the institutions of our country, the media, the executive branch, the legislative branch, the legal institutions, and they are creating a racist, sexist, class-oppressive society that is destroying the planet. And frankly, unless and until the United States of America engages in a broad and deep democracy movement, we're never going to be able to solve the problems that face us, because solutions exist, but they're not implemented because we, the people, do not actually control our own government in this country.
You've got many conventions on economic democracy, earth democracy, racial equality. I assume that you expect to attract constituencies that are focused on all these areas and more.
That is our hope. We are working with people who are on the ground, grassroots activists in each and every one of those subject areas. Imagine the Democracy Convention as a series of interrelated conferences. Each one of those areas that you've described will have a mini conference taking place concurrently, but at the same time, we will be into the agenda opportunities for multi-issue, multi-sector panels, so we break down some of the silos that oftentimes get created within the progressive movement and within issue activism. So you'll hear people who are leaders within the racial justice movement sitting next to people in the environmental movement, sitting next to people in the anti-imperialism, peace and justice movement, all talking about how can we work together. That's the vision of the Democracy Convention, and frankly, I encourage your listeners, your readers, to join with us in Madison, Wisconsin, August 25th through 28th. Let's join the rest of the world in a democracy movement.
This is a very tall order, because what you have here is what would usually be associated with different caucuses in a large gathering, but then bringing them together as caucuses into a more general body.
You're right. This would normally be done within caucuses, and quite frankly, we would expect that this to be the work of a political party. But what we recognize today is that the genuine progressive left does not really have a political party that is really functioning that many people belong to. You know, the Democratic Party leadership are corporatist, militarist, and imperialist, and yet the rank and file members of the Democratic Party are infinitely more progressive. The Green Party exists, but it has not attracted the constituencies that I wished it would have attracted. There are small socialist parties across the country, but none of them have really become the broad-based political party. So we're trying to work in parallel with political parties, but do what a really mature progressive political party would be doing if there was actually a workers' party in the United States of America.
Let's look at some of these categories or mini conventions. You have one that is called Democratic Defense, People Power Over War and Peace. What do you envision happening there?
Well, for one thing, we want to help to engage folks in a sense of willingness to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience in opposition to the illegitimate, immoral, illegal, and unconstitutional wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and those that will come. Because sadly, we know that there will continue to be wars over resources. These are wars of empire. They're not traditional nation-state empires. This new postmodern empire is corporate empire. It's certainly paid for by tax dollars, lubricated with the blood, sweat, and tears of the U.S. service personnel. And, of course, it kills people, particularly people of color, all across the world. But it's not to build the typical nation-state empire. It's now merely to fuel the profits of big corporations. And so what do we do about it? Number one, we think that we need to embolden people to engage in the kind of nonviolent civil disobedience that past movements have been willing to engage in. But in addition to that, we want to expose some of the hidden history of this country of past generations. For example, did you know that there was an effort to amend the U.S. Constitution called the Ludlow Amendment? it would have required that after Congress declared war, before the president was able to execute it, before the war would actually be formally declared, there would be a vote of the people, and it would require a majority of Americans to approve congressional action to declare a war. That was called the Ludlow Amendment, and I discovered that it came within a few votes of Congress from being actually sent to the states for potential ratification. I mean, that's a hidden history. I didn't even know about that until recently, but there are all sorts of tactics and tools that we can discover and that we could share together in terms of best practices to say, how can we take ourselves seriously as an anti-war movement? How can we take ourselves seriously? What would it look like if we actually began to conduct ourselves in ways where we expected to actually stop the war machine? I don't want to just be right in the coffee shop. I don't want to just be able to articulate the problem. I want a path to victory. I want to win.
Which brings us to the Constitutional Reform mini-convention, amending our basic law.
Well, it does bring us to that because I think ultimately all of these issues that we talk about as progressives, as leftists, ultimately we have to come to terms with the fact that the legal system is not designed, it does not act and function as an administrator of justice. The legal system in the United States continues to ensure that the wealthy elite are able to legalize their oppression, to legalize the destruction of the planet. That's what it does. We think that if there is a movement that does take itself seriously, we're going to have to come to terms with the basic law of the land. The supreme law of the land in American jurisprudence is the Constitution. So if we're going to actually take ourselves seriously, we have to grapple with what sort of legal system do we want. We know your program, week after week, the writings at Black Agenda Report, in excruciating detail, outline just how profoundly racist the criminal justice system is, for example. You also frequently describe the workings of the political system. You frequently describe how corporate America and these big, huge transnational corporations are engaged in horrific, oppressive, and abusive conduct. Yet most of the things that you report, even as reprehensible as they are, most of those things are legal, and that's a problem. We know the U.S. Constitution is providing the basic framework for how our government is structured. It defines the relationship between the federal government, the states, and the people within the states. So at the end of the day, we say any movement that wants to make truly systemic and fundamental change in this country must grapple with the fact that the United States of America is not now, nor has it ever been. In fact, it was not actually designed to be a functioning democratic republic, but we believe it can be.
And you also have a racial equality mini-convention. I assume that means that this larger convention does not look at the present day as race-neutral.
No, we do not. I've said it before, I'll say it again, the United States of America is profoundly racist. The reverberations of the not only the genocide of the indigenous people who were already here when this land was colonized, immediately thereafter, of course, slave labor built this country. The echo of that genocide and the echo of the enslavement of Africans is something that we have got to come to terms with. I am a white person myself. I'm not interested in a conversation where we make white people feel guilty. I am, however, interested in justice. And what I understand is that in order to get to justice, we've got to actually come to terms with oppression. And that means issues of race, gender, and class. And we don't make any bones about the fact that we live in a racist, sexist, class-oppressive society today. Now, I also do want to acknowledge that it is a profoundly important thing that an African-American is in the White House. But as you have articulated frequently, Obama's election was an opportunity. It was not a victory. It was an opportunity, and frankly, that opportunity has been squandered. And we don't need to spend time on this particular program outlining the ways in which President Obama and his corporatist militarist agenda have played out to the detriment of all working people and especially people of color.
And why Madison, Wisconsin?
Of course, we know that Madison, Wisconsin is one of the flashpoints to fight back. Governor Scott Walker, the Tea Party favorite when he came in to be elected governor, made a wholesale attack on working people in that state. He did it on the backs of the poor and working folks. He literally engaged in budget windfalls to big corporations and began making huge cuts to the corporate tax rates of the wealthy and corporations, and then tried to shove it down the throats of Wisconsinites by slashing the budget of social services, and began an attack on public sector workers and unions. That's because the public sector unions are the last really organized group of workers in this country. Frankly, most organized labor in the private sector has been busted at this point, and the legal system has allowed it to happen. So we're choosing Madison, Wisconsin, because it's in the heartland, because the city of Madison is multiracial and multiethnic, and because it is a place symbolically where we know that the movement took root. Remember, La Follette from the 1800s was one of the early folks actually talking about the merger of the duopoly of the two established political parties. We also know that Wisconsin was one of the hotbeds of the abolition movement and the women's movement in the early days of this country. There is a great historical legacy of positive progressive left action that we want to draw upon.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Jason Taubenfeld.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.